Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Thing is on and it is working, and we are live from Radio Row, brought to you courtesy of Families USA. Radio Row in on Capitol Hill, directly across Maryland Avenue from the Supreme Court of the United States, where today there are gathered, I'd say, several hundred individuals, both for and against, both pro and con, relative to King versus Burwell, the ongoing discussion. The ongoing debate, the ongoing legal ginned up, rooped up, frogged up, faced up controversy created by a bunch of no good, motherless, soulless, godless Republicans, teabaggers, and coke people who are dedicated to taking health care away from several millions of American citizens. They're chanting, they're singing. Right wings there. We're, probably a grand total of about maybe 150 feet away from them. We're indoors, though, so you're not going to hear any of that. We'll have conversations today from a wide variety of people who have, what's that word from Hobby Lobby? Deeply held, that phrase, deeply held convictions about why people should be able to continue to go to the doctor when they're sick and not have their health care taken away from them by a gang of right-wing ideologues who are screaming, freedom! Right? Yeah. Unfortunately, that's what it's about. The arguments going on today in King versus Burwell. And we'll be talking, let's see, just to give you an idea here. Of course, we're live, as noted. And we will be live from now until 3 o'clock. At that point in time, the one and only inimitable, except no substitutes, Guy James will take over for the remaining 2 hours. And then we'll tear this whole thing down and get on the road back to the hills and hollers of almost level West Bycole, Virginia, where people need health care particularly badly insofar as the coal industry poisons them every day of their lives. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. And, of course, you might recall that we are listener-supported. This has been going on our little radio network for 10 years now via your kind and generous support that keeps it all going. And if you want to be part of the continuing support of The Horn, well, by golly, run on over to headonradionetwork.com, click on the tab Contribute. The PayPal interface is there. And then, of course, I've got to add this to the website. We've got the postal address, the U.S. Postal Service address, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, West Virginia, 25801. And thank you, however it is that you do go about supporting this ongoing broadcast effort. Let's see. I've already got our first conversational guest here of the day, and we will we'll get started just in a very short moment. Yeah, there we go. Manisha Sharma is with us. Let me get your mic on, Manisha.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and welcome to The Horn. Welcome
you.
To Conversation Radio. Let me make sure that I've got good level coming from you.
Sure.
You're wonderful. You sound great.
Okay.
Is that a Brooklyn Dodgers?
Brooklyn.
Awesome. Awesome. You are a director of leadership cultivation for Doctors for America. We've That's already right. talked to a couple of your colleagues. And you head up the King versus Burwell Task Force
that
within Doctors for America. You're a family physician.
I am.
You're ground zero for wellness and preventive care there in New York. And you're also very much an activist, I take it.
Yes, I am, sir. But I'm actually now in Baltimore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just new implant to transplant to Baltimore.
So do you say it Balmer yet?
Balmore. Balmore.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Not quite the same as New York.
No, really. Not quite. But missing New York, but it's all right.
Yeah. Well, again, welcome aboard, and thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
To advance the access to health care in this country. Obviously, you would not be here if this didn't matter a great deal to you.
That's correct.
Obviously, you care about it from a physician standpoint, but by the same token, this is a human rights issue too, isn't it?
It is a human rights issue. I care about this as a physician, but I also care about this as a patient. I am a patient as well, right?
Sure.
And so, you know, yes, the ACA, we fought very hard to get it passed so we could have more access to health care for the nation. Today's case, and the word on the street right now, is that it actually went very well in our favor. The oral arguments, they just came out of the Supreme Court.
I was hoping somebody might know something.
Yes, so that's the word on the street, that actually the arguments were in our favor. And actually, Scalia was quoted, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was something to the effect of saying that this is disastrous. This could be detrimental to our nation's health. This is really important stuff. You know, the thing about why this case is so clearly important and why it's hard to talk about is because of very policy, legal, you know, jargon that's used a lot with
Well, absolutely. And I guess you can kind of get lost in the nerd weeds.
You could, right.
On this. But we discussed a little bit of this yesterday. This is by no means... This isn't the constitutional argument over the legality of the ACA.
Right.
That train left the station two
That's
years
right.
ago.
Exactly.
This is something that I can't wrap my head around, except to say, Doctor, that apparently we have people in this country who think so lowly of ordinary working American citizens
Correct.
That they feel like that they're somehow privileged and empowered to take health care away from people.
Right. Well, so, you know, it's exactly right. And so, you know, this is about 34 states in America.
Right.
That is actually in some of our most impoverished states in America.
Well, I'm one of them.
And there you're right. Exactly. In West Virginia. And this is about the fact that the ACA's law says, you know, hey, if you don't have a state exchange, you can get onto the federal exchange, and we're going to help you pay for it,
right.
And we're going to help you get health care access. And so in those 34 states, we're talking about really hardworking people, working
millions of working people,
10 million working people, and two-thirds of those people are the ones that are going to be affected if they're going to be able to if the tax credit gets taken away from them.
So how does that work in the real world? I mean, as a physician on the front line doing family practice, your patients come in the door, they've got an insurance card, and you've got somebody who handles all the paperwork and,
right.
and all those issues. But realistically speaking, if they lose their coverage, you're not going to see them anymore, are you?
And they're going to get sicker. So I'll give you an example. I have a patient who I always talk about her, and this is because I saw her pre the ACA and then post the ACA, okay? And this is a person who's 62 years old, hardworking woman. She was too rich for Medicaid. She was too poor to get health insurance on her own. Her job didn't give her health insurance, and she's too young for Medicare. Okay, her job was to take care of kids. That's what she does for her community.
Mm-hmm.
She has diabetes. Now, people don't realize why diabetes is such a big deal. It's because it's one of the top leading problems in our nation. And folks are really unaware that when you have insulin, when you need insulin for diabetes, it can cost you anywhere from $200 to $400 a month if you don't have health insurance.
Well, I'm type 2 myself, and I know you can go broke on the test strips alone.
Exactly, just on that alone. So imagine being uninsured, 62 years old, and you're now having to choose between your medicine and your health. And your rent.
Yeah.
And that's pre-ACA.
Yeah, insulin, groceries, insulin, tires for the car.
And that's what people do day in and day out, and that's what they're struggling with.
And they shouldn't have to, though.
Absolutely not, right. Post-ACA, when we had it, she actually was one of those people who was able to get this tax credit,
mm-hmm.
okay? And a tax credit so she could actually afford health insurance, so now she doesn't have to worry because she has health insurance that covers, a prescription coverage that actually covers her medicine.
Have you had access to any of the numbers for what the, with and without tax credit costs look like?
Could be. Well, so it can look different ways for different people.
Sure.
So we just heard outside at the rally of a gentleman who has Crohn's disease where it used to be where he had no health insurance and it cost him thousands of dollars a month, almost as much as his mortgage. And with the ACA, he was able to save money. He actually got it cut by two-thirds and he was able to save that money and start his own business. This stuff really affects people's lives. This is about
Absolutely.
Life and death. This is not a sensational statement. It is truly about life
and
death.
It's existential.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, then I'm calling on you for some speculation here. If you know, what does the other side propose by way of an alternative or a remedy?
Because nothing.
I was over there and all I saw, I was surprised I didn't see any of their hateful yellow snake flags.
Oh, they're there.
Oh,
they were there.
Oh, lucky me. But all I saw were signs about, you know, we hate the IRS.
Yeah.
IRS, if I was a little bit crankier, Manisha, if I was just a... Because I can be.
You're a nice Southern gentleman.
No. I'm behaving right now. I saw Steve King from Iowa. We call him Steve Cantaloupe's King because he's the guy who said that Mexican teenagers with calves the size of cantaloupes were, oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
But I wanted to stand there and just yell just for the fun of it, just to see what all the little weirdos would do. I wanted to yell, Benghazi! Because it's kind of like a duck call with them, you know? Whack! Benghazi! But all they had were signs about how much they hate the IRS.
Right.
They really don't have an alternative, do they?
Well, you know, it's really easy to tear things down, right?
Sure.
And blow things up. But it's not really easy to build things, you know, and it's unfortunate. And, yes, they don't have a solution. There's never been a solution that's actually put forth. You know, our own president has been asking, show me what your alternatives
right.
are. And you haven't been able to lay them out. It's become spin. And it's unfortunate.
And one of the most frustrating parts of all of this is the fact that these are, this is a health care plan, the ACA, that got its start not at all far from here
mm-hmm.
in the halls of the Heritage Foundation. This thing started out as a Republican idea, and suddenly they don't like their own idea anymore.
No, they don't like their idea. They don't like their idea anymore. Massachusetts, remember
mm-hmm.
the ACA was built off of Massachusetts. Mitt Romney, exactly. 98% of Massachusetts is covered.
Do you think if Barack Obama had been a Republican and put this forward, that we'd be dealing with any of this right now?
That's a great question.
They'd be screaming that it was the best thing that happened since sliced bread, wouldn't they? Of course, I don't know if that party would allow a man like Barack Obama to be a member of their party, if you know what I mean. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Right?
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
But
yeah.
But they have no alternatives, and for somebody like your patient, to be thrown off of her health care and suddenly not have access to it, that's not only life-changing, that is life-threatening.
Exactly.
And if you've got one, you've got to have 100, right?
Exactly. Well, and there's thousands. I mean, we're talking millions. Remember, these are millions of people who are
yes.
going to be affected if this does not go our way. And there's millions of people that are going to be affected in states that are have working folks. This is the southern states we're talking about.
Sure, absolutely.
Your state we're talking about. So, I mean, you know, we need to give a damn.
In West Virginia and Central Appalachia, we're pre-poisoned for their convenience.
I mean, right, from the cold. Exactly.
Well, Manisha Sharma, thank you so much for stopping
by. It was a pleasure having me. Thank you.
Enjoy Radio Row, and you really, really bring life to the issue very, very well.
Thank you so much. No problem. Take care.
And we'll be talking, and it gets a little bit harem scarum here because it's just kind of like chair empties, chair fills, one conversation after another. So give me just a moment here so that I can get the right information up so that I don't refer
Certainly.
To you as someone you aren't. In point of fact, we're talking now with Michelle Boyle. She's a registered nurse, an RN. At Allegheny General Hospital in Duburg.
Duburg, that's right, yeah. Pittsburgh.
Yeah. You guys want to go down to Eaton Park, get some gravy fries?
Yep.
After we get done here, we'll have a little imp and iron.
Yeah.
I speak a little Berg.
Excellent.
Welcome to the Horn, and thank you for coming to this Radio Row and being a part of the advocacy for people to continue having access to health care. I don't know. If the other side wins, I think we've got a real disaster on our hands, don't you?
Yeah, as a nurse and as I signed the amicus to the court in regards to this case, I absolutely believe there's a disaster pending. And in my own personal life, I've had that experience.
How so?
Before the Affordable Care Act came into play, my mother-in-law, she lost her job. They hired someone whose health insurance didn't cost them as much. So obviously she lost her health care. Mm-hmm. COBRA, I don't know anybody who can afford COBRA.
I tried to once.
Yeah, I tried to as well, and I just went without health insurance. So that was completely unaffordable, and she suffered from high blood pressure, and also she was getting early stages of Parkinson's. And so there, my husband and I went to go visit her in December. This was about 10 months after she lost her job. And we looked at her and we're like, you should come visit us. And we were living in another state at the time, and because we were just going to keep her with us and try to see what we could do about her health care, because she was not looking good. She was not receiving the treatment that she needed. But she never made it.
Oh my God.
She died before we could get her. She was only 58.
I'm so sorry. This is really how it works, and this is the kind of thing that's at stake for millions of people in this country, isn't it?
It really is, Bob. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. And had the Affordable Care Act been available at that time, this was 16 years ago. She would be alive,
because so many of these cases and what makes them such tragedies is the fact that we're not talking about incurable disease.
No,
we're talking
no.
about people dying from want of access to health care, not
Absolutely.
From dying from disease. You can make the argument that in the case you just described, she didn't die from the combination of her afflictions. She died from a country that doesn't care enough about its citizens to keep that from happening.
That's one of the reasons why I signed on to the amicus, is because I'm very confounded as to it as a nurse, as a mother, as a daughter, as a wife. It really, I have no comprehension of somebody who could turn around and say to somebody, "You don't deserve health care. You know,
and that's,
your life isn't worth."
And for me, that's the disconnect in this case. Is that, I mean, somewhere, and I don't know where their office is, but somewhere there's the headquarters of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they're the people who are behind this. And there are people who get in, who leave their homes every morning, and they get in their cars, and they drive through this atrocious, god-awful D.C. traffic to get to work at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and then they spend their day trying to make sure that suffering Americans can't have health care. Now, for me, I mean, there's something fundamentally immoral in all of that. Do you think that they just compartmentalize it away, or I mean, how do you get through a day doing that? If you're one of the billionaires who funds the Competitive Enterprise Institute, are you just so baptized in your own sense of privilege that you feel like that from your lofty perch that you can look down at us proles down here and say that one dies, that one dies, and that one dies, and these people don't need health care because freedom. Coming from West Virginia, as I do, you may recall last year we had 300,000 people get poisoned. You know, they got their water poisoned.
Yes, I do remember that.
I refer to that now. It was Freedom Industries. I refer to it as the freedom disaster now. I just take out the industries. Because that's what we've got with these right-wingers, these Republicans, is this constant argument that some notion that only they have of freedom trumps the needs of over 300 million people. And
it's astounding.
It is astounding. What do you find? There's an old joke that says Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh in the west and Philly in the east and Alabama in the middle. You work in nursing. What kind of attitudes are you seeing among people who have health care now for the first time in God knows how long, if ever?
Relief.
Relief.
I see relief. I see people who feel that they can breathe easier. I don't know everybody's health insurance. When you're in the hospital, believe me, as I'm sure you can imagine, nurses are busy enough without finding out everybody's thing. But, you know, but from my experience is that we are, you know, of course we get admissions from the ER, and now we're getting more admissions from doctor's offices. So people don't have to use the ER as their source of health care.
And that, on the one hand, that cuts costs, but doesn't it also mean that you're more likely to have a positive outcome?
Absolutely.
Because that means that the doctor has gotten in front of whatever disease process it is at the office level, and so the sooner you get into it, the better off people are?
Absolutely, Bob. That is exactly what is happening. It means that we can actually do something. It means that we can get our patients more onto a healing basis instead of coming from way behind. And it's like, well, okay, if we had seen the diabetic foot with just a wound on it,
we
wouldn't be doing the amputation.
So now you're seeing more, you're doing more wound care than amputation? I mean, that's a little specific, but...
That's one example, but certainly, we're being able to do that more.
You're doing great. Are you a Pittsburgh native?
I'm not.
No.
No, I grew up in Cleveland.
of all the places, and you wind up in Pittsburgh.
I know.
But you're at Allegheny General. I mean, that's why I asked.
I am, yes.
And that is a first line of defense kind of hospital, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely,
huge,
yeah.
Huge ER.
Yes, yes. I work on a post-surgical floor, but we have a huge ER where, you know, the hospital itself is a level one trauma center. Mm-hmm. So of course, we're a big hospital in the region, and we certainly see, we have people really coming from all over the state because if there's big, I'm on a post-transplant floor. Mm-hmm. So we're post-surgical, and we also do kidney transplants. So we get people from everywhere. Like if someone needs a transplant, it's the closest place is our hospital.
And even major procedures like that, is it safe to say that you've seen a change there as well? Because if you have no health care coverage and somebody says, well, you need a kidney.
Well, you know, You know, Bob, it's not even if you had health care coverage, because we had a patient on our floor before the Affordable Care Act came into play. So as you, without going into too many details, as you can imagine, getting a transplanted organ, there's a lot of chronic medications you need to be on so your body doesn't reject the organ.
Right.
Okay, but
and some insurance companies were still calling would refuse coverage on the basis of experimental procedure, right?
Not as much, but in the one case with my patient, or with the patient that was on our floor, is that she was having the discussion with her husband, who he was just diagnosed with cancer, and he needed chemotherapy. And the discussion that they were having was, no, I will stop my transplant medication so you can get chemotherapy. And he was saying, no, this was a gift. You know, you got this kidney. It's changed your life. We will figure out something else other than the chemotherapy.
What kind of a calculus is that? I can't even begin to conceive of the that conversation. How do you even discuss that through the tears? You know what I mean?
She loved her husband, mm-hmm. and obviously they both cared for each other. But you know, she's back on dialysis. Her husband, you know, being able to be with the man that she loves for as long as possible, was more important to her.
Astonishing.
Which, quite honestly, I probably would have made the same decision. But
sure.
I think any of us would.
Well,
and
really,
they had health insurance. That's the inconceivable part of this is that they had health insurance, but it wasn't affordable. You know, that's why I signed the amicus, is because this is about the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
It's really kind of in, you know, what the law is called, the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
It's right there. Like,
well,
I don't know how much clearer you can get.
Right, because if the other side gets away with what they want to do, it's not like health care is going to go away. It's not like health care insurance is going to go away. It's just going to become unaffordable. It's going to become inaccessible.
I think what I would say...
$125 a month, and this goes away, and your premium goes up to a house payment per month, it's no longer accessible, is it?
I would argue that that's health care gone away. I mean, that's what happened to my mother-in-law. It's gone. I mean, you're taking away health care from people who are working hard and trying to provide for their family. It's gone. I mean, should families have to choose between having a house over their head or having health care? Should they choose between feeding their children or having health care? Should, you know, a wife be saying, I was given this miracle, but what's more important to me is that you live longer and you get the chemotherapy that you need? I mean, those are I feel they're impossible. And at the same time, I have to say, it does show the true spirit of the American people, because we're there for each other, the actual American people, the people that I see day to day, the families that are there, they're there to provide for each other.
It reminds me of the old legal maxim that justice delayed is justice denied. Healthcare priced out of the market is no healthcare at all.
Exactly.
And, wow. Well, thank you for what you do for your patients. Thank you for your activism in this matter. And we'll cross our fingers, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Michelle Boyle, thank you so very kindly. And safe travels going back to the Berg.
Thank you very much.
All right, be well.
Take care.
A lot of good conversations to be had here on Radio Row with a lot of committed people. Yeah, Ferg.
May I just say, the story that I just heard has broken me down.
There are a million of those kinds of stories all over the country.
Somehow. Yeah, but to think about the amount of love that would take just to decide who's going to live longer, who's going to live healthier, and the fact that we have to make that choice.
Well, I understand that, but the thing is, we don't have to make that choice. That's what she was getting at. It's the affordable aspect. It's not just having health care. insurance. It's having health care that is affordable. And those choices don't necessarily have to happen if we're a country that cares enough about its own population.
But the other side is way too greedy to even.
Well, it's past. I think I don't know. I use words like depraved. So we are joined now here on Radio Row at about half past noon Eastern Standard Time. We're joined by Vinnie DeMarco, who comes to us from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He is with the he's the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, and he teaches at Johns Hopkins in health, behavior, and society. So your specialty, doctor, then, is actually what we're talking about today: how a culture interfaces with on a macro scale to yield micro results in individual lives. Is that a safe pair?
Well, you know, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, and I'm glad you guys are here. We got to get this message out. The Affordable Care Act has been a big success. We've gotten health care coverage to over 11 million people, many of whom had no coverage at all. Many of them had poor coverage, but now they have the health care coverage they need. And in Maryland, we've been listening to stories of people who have benefited from it. And I'll tell you one that really sticks in my head. A woman told us how for years she had no health care coverage. Her husband worked full time, but they couldn't afford it. So desperate, she went to her local health department and said, "Can you at least cover my kids?" And they said to her, "Well, yes, and now there's a new law that covers you." And they gave her a car. She didn't know that, but now she had a health care card. A few weeks later, she wasn't feeling well. Had she not had that card, she would have tried to sleep it off. She wouldn't have seen a doctor, but she had the card. So she went to see a doctor. The doctor examined her and said, "Thank goodness you came here. You were developing something that would have killed you. But now, with this card, we can give you what you need to stay alive." And she came to our press conference and said, "Thank you for saving my life." And I wish all the members of the Supreme Court could hear her tell her story, because that's what this is about, saving lives. And in addition, and this is important for listeners to understand, if she had not had that card and gone to the hospital and run up a huge bill, she couldn't have paid it, and her husband probably couldn't have paid it. Who would have paid it? All of us.
Sure.
A huge part of our insurance goes to cover the uninsured. We call that a hidden health care tax. So when you cover people with insurance, we all benefit.
And in point of fact, she may never have showed up at the ER at all.
Right.
And sometimes showing up at the ER, you know, there's no guarantee that you get complete diagnosis,
right,
prognosis,
right,
and treatment, or treatment prognosis. You get what the what federal law refers to as stabilization.
Right.
And, you know, stabilization is a far cry from, well, it's the difference between palliation and cure, right?
Right.
And so even the ER bill that she would have run up there, if she survived, because that's at the base of all of this, is no answer. So
yes.
I'm having a hard time, doctor, understanding the mindset of the other side on this.
Well, it's a good question. I'm afraid that there's just a group of people in America who ideologically oppose President Obama and everything he's done, and oppose the Affordable Care Act. And this is their last gasp. They tried to throw it out in court. The Supreme Court said, no, it stays. They tried to throw it out in the election, and President Obama got reelected. And now they're trying again. And they try all the time in Congress, which never goes anywhere. This is their last gasp, and I don't think they're going to succeed. The Supreme Court, number one, isn't going to want to throw 11 million people off their health care. And number two, they're going to see that the law was designed correctly. It was designed to provide subsidies for everybody in states like Maryland that have a state exchange and a state like Texas that don't. It would make no sense to have a law with subsidies only in states with state exchanges. So I think the Supreme Court's going to uphold the law as it is.
Well, to adopt the other side's, the plaintiff's position in this, would effectively allow states to nullify. It would allow states to nullify a federal law.
Would not exactly. Good
and
way
mean,
to put it. Yes.
And we had the nullification debate 155 years
yes,
ago, right?
Yes. Yeah. And the primacy of the union won. Exactly. And now, one important thing to remember is, even in states with state exchanges, they would be hurt by this law because it would roil the insurance markets all across the country. Insurance works when everybody participates, when there's a large group of people putting in their money for their premiums,
right,
that allows the insurance system to work. If that doesn't happen, we're going to have trouble everywhere. This would be a terrible disaster, a wrong decision. I think they're going to affirm the law.
I just, for the life of me, I can't understand, Doctor, why, you know, politics being politics. I can't, because I saw, for instance, Representative Steve King of Iowa standing out there running his mouth this morning, and they had signs about the IRS. You know, that's their focus in this. They might as well have had signs about Benghazi. I can't imagine that the GOP, responsive as it is to money and capital and influence, that somebody from these large insurance companies hasn't picked up the phone and said, listen, what are you people thinking? Because the insurance companies are not going broke on this, are they?
No.
It's good for them.
It wasn't intended to make anybody broke. It was intended to make the whole country better, and that's what it's doing. But I think you're making a good point. I mean, conservatives need to know that it's not a very conservative thing to roil the markets like this court decision would do. It wouldn't. A decision for the plaintiffs here would not be a conservative decision. It would be a radically bad decision.
And it's decades now that we've been listening to the right wing talk about how they're the party of family values. Where is the family value in throwing a family off of health care and thereby subjecting them to, you know, potentially not only catastrophic health care outcomes, but catastrophic crippling
bankruptcy. Yes,
sure.
You're right. It doesn't make any sense. That's why I think Supreme Court's going to affirm this for two reasons. One, the law is clear. The law is correct. And second, it would just be disastrous for the country.
Well, we have one of my earlier conversations, Dr. Sharma told me that they were hearing on the street that the questioning had been pretty one-sided today in the Supreme Court. But, of course, you can never tell what that means. But that even Tony Scalia was saying this would be disastrous.
That's interesting.
One never knows, but I can't. The thing is, it's the uncertainty that plays into this that makes this so terrifying. I mean, if you're an insurance executive, what do you do between, you know, it's March the 4th. What do you do between now and June the 30th when this decision is due?
You're absolutely right.
There's rate setting that has to go on. How can you do? And again, the right wing and the Republicans are forever talking about, you know, we've got to have certainty in the economy. Well, isn't this just throwing uncertainty right into the mix?
The Supreme Court should affirm it soon to avoid that. I agree with you completely. The more this is in doubt, the worse it is.
So you would not be surprised then to see a decision come out before the closing?
You would hope so. I think the court understands that it's very important that they act soon. But who knows? All I know is people like my friend in Maryland who desperately needs insurance they have, and millions like her, are really, I'm sure, praying that Supreme Court does the right thing.
So so you are involved deeply in this entire issue. Let me ask you this. Assuming that this case gets bounced the way it should be, are there fixes that yet need to be dealt with?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a good question. And everybody understands that the Affordable Care Act is not the end of the road on health care. And one of the things we're looking at in Maryland to build on this progress is to help bring the community together with the medical providers to provide better care and in the hospitals and in the community. One thing we looked at is a model in Memphis, Tennessee, called the Congregational Health Network, where local congregations entered into a covenant with the hospital to work together to help people so that when someone leaves the hospital, there's someone in the community who can talk with the hospital staff and help get the person what they need. That has worked dramatically to reduce costs and keep people healthy. We're going to replicate that in Maryland. We're calling it the Faith Community Health Network. Check out healthcareforall.com, our website. You'll see all about this. And hopefully next time we talk with each other, I can tell you more detail about how it goes.
I look forward to it. Well, let me ask you one more question, because obviously today we're in the Supreme Court, we're dealing with people who are getting insurance through the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But in, and it's largely the states of the old Confederacy where they rejected the Medicare, Medicaid expansion. Do you or your organization, are you looking at, is there anything that can be done to remedy the fact that, you know, how many millions of people are there in Texas who cannot get any form of health care? What's the go forward on that? I mean, are we just stuck until we get a responsible Congress?
Well, you know, the issue of states like Texas, which did not accept the Medicaid expansion, is a serious one. There are millions of people in Texas who could easily have full health care coverage at very little cost to the state of Texas, but that's been rejected. Very, very sad. I know a lot of states with Republican governors who in the past opposed it are now opening themselves up to...
Well, Jan Brewer accepted it in Arizona, didn't
And John Kasich in Ohio. Yeah. So it's not a Democrat versus Republican thing. It's just there are certain governors and legislators who, God knows why, want to reject billions of dollars to help their people.
I think about people of the poor working class in places like Louisiana and Mississippi.
It's very sad
and
for
Alabama,
them, yes.
And Georgia and South Carolina.
Yeah.
It begins to feel like a direct and personal assault upon them.
Yeah, it's very important that every state accept the Medicaid expansion, and what it's going to take to do that, I don't know. But let's get past today and have the Supreme Court affirm the Affordable Care Act. Then we can talk about that, and we can talk about like this Memphis congregational health model to even build on the progress we've made.
If we get past today and we survive this challenge. Is this the end of this stuff, or are they just going to keep throwing stuff at the walls until something...
Well, hopefully at some point courts will just throw them out right away.
Shouldn't this have been thrown out from the
get-go? You would think so, yeah.
I mean, they've got dummied-up plaintiffs. They've got they've got a non-constitutional issue. You've got issues of justiciability and standing. I think you've even got ripeness and mootness thrown in here as well. I'm astonished that somewhere along the way it wasn't bounced, it wasn't thrown out.
Hopefully it will be now.
Amen to that. Amen
right.
to that.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Marker, thank you very, very much, and I wish you the very best replicating that model in Maryland, and
yes.
I do look forward to hearing from you about
it. Yes, next time we'll talk about that.
All right,
thank
take
you.
Care. Bye-bye. That was Dr. Vincent DeMarco from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Also president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. We thank him very much for coming by. Let's see, we've got a little bit of a gap in the schedule here. Let me see.
It's quite the gap, folks. Quite the gap.
Well, we've got about a 30-minute gap, and that might afford time for a little bit of a break.
Okay.
After which we will resume because we start up again at 1:15 and go straight through to 3 without any let up whatsoever.
Okay, well, I highly suggest at this point in time you should probably go next door and check out the Supreme Court, see what's going on.
Well, I think we might both do that.
Well, I have already been out there, and to be completely honest, it's changing.
Okay. Well, we'll go and
the crowd is becoming quite interesting.
Well, and we'll go and grab a bite too because. They're putting out lunch.
Okay.
All right. So you're listening to live coverage from Radio Row, Capitol Hill, brought to you by the good offices of Families USA. We will take a brief break and come back with, let's see, my goodness, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We got 7 more people for you to hear from. So please stand by. And we'll get right back at it. You're listening to Live Conversation Radio. You're listening to The Horn. Listener supported. I'm Bob Kincaid. And we are back live from Radio Row, Capitol Hill, the Methodist building across from the Supreme Court of the United States. It's about 16 minutes past the hour. This, of course, Wednesday on the Horn, the fourth day of March 2015. We're joined at this point in time by Reverend Cynthia Abrams. Reverend Abrams comes to us from the... Oh, I just... Comes to us from the... alcohol, other addictions, and health care program of the United Methodist Church.
General Board of Church and Society. Okay. I'm now called Director of Health and Wholeness.
Oh, okay.
That's my new title.
Congratulations. I hope it came with a pay raise.
It came with more work.
Yeah, that's usually how it plays out, isn't it?
No, it's all good.
you've come out of a social justice tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked among First Peoples in New York State,
mm-hmm.
And so with your association with the General Board here, I guess it's natural that you would be affiliated and associated with this particular controversy and this particular issue, health care and access to health care. What is your what's your take thus far on what we've seen in the last day or so with King versus Burwell?
Well, I think to put it in perspective, I guess all along this has been a journey, the Affordable Care Act, that none of us could have imagined. It's unfortunate that it's become politicized. And the church, there's a large interfaith coalition of people, Jewish, Muslims, mainline Christian denominations, et cetera, who have been involved in working for greater access to health care for decades. And the United Methodist Church, even from its inception, has had a story, a witness, and a heart for health care. We say healthcare is a basic human right, and so when things happen like this, King versus Burwell, it's unfortunate for us because we think it's pretty clear what the moral imperative is for us. We're connected as people. We're created in the image of God, and we care for each other. The call is for us to care for each other equally and value each other equally, and it seems to me the politicizing of healthcare has really dismantled that or gotten in the way of us really getting at the essence of who we are as people of faith. And so part of our witness is to remind people what the moral imperative is, what God calls us to do, what is God's vision for God's people to thrive, to care, and that God loved people so much that God sent God's Son, and then Jesus sent to us an example. One of the examples I talk about is the story in the New Testament of Jesus and the hemorrhaging woman. It's a pretty clear roadmap if you look at that story and kind of tie it into the contemporary context. What does Jesus do when the woman touches the hem of his garment?
His disciples have a little conniption right off the bat.
Right, because she violates Jewish purity law by touching the garment of a rabbi. She's a hemorrhaging woman. She's not well. She's an outcast in society. She touches his garment, so she violates this purity law. And so what does Jesus do? Does he ignore her? Does he admonish her? Does he tell her to go away? No, he doesn't. He addresses her. And when he addresses her, that's astonishing, too, because he's not supposed to do that either. So he's violent.
That's how she's a woman and everything.
Right, exactly. And a woman who's sick, who's hemorrhaging, who's bleeding, who's impure. And so so what does he do? He ends up healing her. He ends up, talking to her and then healing her. So align that with contemporary times. How should we act in this situation or in the situation of creating greater access for health care for people? Jesus says you should seek out and heal the outcast, those on the margins. Well, who's more on the margins than people who can't afford health care? And so we have a special responsibility.
Well, and there's the whole concept there of feed my sheep. There's a big divide, Reverend, between progressive or liberal Christianity and what I call right-wing evangelical fundamentalists. I don't. I when I read scripture, I'm reading the same Jesus you're reading. He said, suffer the little children to come unto me, not, come on, y'all, let's go make the little children suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other side, I remember when they justified the Iraq War, the Southern Baptist Convention, by saying, well, Peter had a sword.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting how, who is it? I think Anne Lamott says, if God seems to agree with you on everything that you believe, you may have made God into your own image. And I think it, what's very important for us to do is to be authentically critical and analyzing what our theology and our faith says about these things. And I don't think you can ignore that Jesus had a heart for the poor, that Jesus reached out especially to the poor and the outcast. He did it time and time again.
He spends a lot more time talking about the poor than he does talking about the gays or any of the other hated pluralities that the right wing likes to finger point at. And in particular, getting somebody health care in this country does not have to be a miracle.
No, it doesn't.
It feels a little like it sometimes.
Because people make it more complicated than it is, because they, by complicating it, it makes it harder for people to understand, and therefore people can impose, you can give people misinformation and they will believe it. So what, I mean, it's really cut and dried. And there are other countries that have done this. And what's interesting to me is that we don't seem to want to look or examine those in a real way. To see how they work and don't work. But we have single payer today anyway in the United States. Every senior over the age of 65, almost every anyway, is eligible for Medicare. Before Medicare, what happened to seniors? They died for lack of health care. Now, from the minute they turn a certain age, they have health care. When Indian Health Service covers American Indians, they have access to health care regardless, and they're able to practice preventative care, which is a more economically sustainable and good stewardship besides.
And isn't that something that you're involved with through the church, is this is an outreach to individual community churches to get them involved in getting health care to people, getting them to sign up, whether it be for ACA coverage or for Medicaid coverage in the states?
Right. We've had churches across the country have been enrollment centers. We have annual conferences that have signed up to be navigators for people to be enrolled. And, of course, historically, many faith groups, including the United Methodist Church, have had health institutions of our own. But, you know, one of the arguments is, well, the churches and the nonprofits should be providing the charitable care for poor people. Well, if we have the wherewithal to do that, why are we not doing that? We're not doing it because we don't have the wherewithal to cover every single person. We struggle on our own to pay for health insurance costs for our own employees and clergy. Are we suddenly going to adopt a whole neighborhood? I think not. So the only thing that makes sense is, where is it that all the connect points are there for us to do a comprehensive look at it and tackle it comprehensively? The government, which is for the people and by the people.
What do you say to those people who argue that that social services, welfare, because, I mean, I doing what I do, I hear this argument all the time from the right, feeding the hungry, that providing assistance to needy families, that this should all be done through the churches, and that we don't need the government collective taking care of people.
So why isn't the churches doing it already then?
Right.
Historically.
Well, the short and easy answer is that they lack capacity.
We don't have the capacity. That's the truth. I mean, if we had the capacity, we'd have done it a long time ago, and then we wouldn't be having this conversation. Same goes for healthcare. If we had the capacity and we're able to do it on our own, why has not someone connected those points together? Let alone the fact that people of faith and communities of faith working together is a struggle in and of itself because of our own ideology within the Christian church. I mean, apart from, you know, U.S. politics, our own politicization of our denominations. I mean, there's so much to overcome.
Do you see a lot of that? I mean, is there has the politicized, the deliberate politicization of Protestantism, and I know it from the Protestant standpoint because of, you know, my own upbringing,
right?
And I think particularly of the Southern Baptist Church. But is that overt, deliberate rightward politicization something that you see in the Methodist Church as well?
Well, the Methodist Church is very diverse. I mean, there's a huge continuum of people, from Hillary Clinton to George Bush, Pete Sessions.
I noticed when the Methodist Church said, George, don't start a war with Iraq. The next thing you know, he's addressing the Southern Baptist Convention.
Right. Well, and conversely, Jimmy Carter was a Southern Baptist, and so was Bill Clinton.
Right.
And they conversed with the Methodists. So, you know, what that says to me is that there's some things that trump faith for some people. And I think, you know, talking about this from some very basic understandings is a way to start. The problem is starting that conversation, trying to have that conversation, and that is very complex. At the end of the day, people are dying because they don't have health care. And we need to make sure that people are covered. And the subsidies are a critical part of, aspect of that. And so I hope that the Supreme Court justices use common sense. You know, my grandmother said, when you can't figure out a problem, just use your common sense, Cynthia. And you'll find a way. And so I don't have a crystal ball about what they do, but I sure hope they follow my grandmother's adage to use common sense.
I hope they do. It would unleash chaos in this country, would it not? And if the churches aren't able to pick up the slack that already exists, they're certainly not going to pick this up.
Yeah, over 8 million people have subsidies who would be adversely affected and probably lose their health insurance. In the United Methodist Church, there are 8.1 million members in the United States. That's like our entire denomination. That many people would be adversely affected by a ruling that would do away with the subsidies. That's a lot of people. Men, women, children. I can't imagine that.
And we've seen the real face of this put on. Families USA has brought in actual consumers. And I think it's probably the most brilliant thing that they have done with this particular radio row. Mm-hmm. Reverend Avers, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. And I look forward to us talking again soon.
Yes. Thank you for the information.
All right, we are going to resume our conversation now. Julie Mansfield is with us now across the microphone from me. Julie, you are one of the people who has health care via the federal exchange. Where are you from?
I'm from Miami, Florida.
Okay, so that means no state exchange. Right.
Absolutely. So this is critical to me.
Well, I extend to you my condolences for having to run around in this frigid hellscape,
yes.
But we really appreciate you being up here.
My pleasure. Is that important to me, to leave 79 degrees for 39?
Oh, My colleague Guy James over there is from Fort Myers, so he's been regaling me with tales of
sunshine.
Warm weather and sunshine. But apart from that, since Florida did not set up a state exchange, you had to rely on the federal exchange. What was your life like before the Affordable Care Act opened coverage and made it available to you?
So between 2009, which is when I lost my health care coverage, my employer sponsored health care coverage, and 2013, which is when the ACA, we were eligible for it, it was sheer hell. It was a constant state of fear and panic and anxiety. And, oh, my God, I can't get sick. I can't get a headache. I can't do anything. Literally couldn't afford to do that.
Please, God, don't let me break a bone.
Please, God, let me not break a bone or get one of those, headaches that last for more than an hour or two or three, because then you start worrying. Oh,
is that one of the conditions that you?
Chronic migraine.
Mm-hmm.
And a host of other things, because the body's like a car.
Right. And when one thing starts, another one soon follows.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So what did you do in the interim to manage? Just nothing.
Just nothing. It's a hope. You live on hope and prayer. Mm-hmm. I hope I don't, but if I do, I pray it's not as bad as it could be. And so yearly annual physicals were put aside. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those women who had an abnormal mammogram and needed to do a mammogram twice a year instead of the once a year, and I couldn't do that. And so just living in that fear.
How do you do that? I mean,
it's sleepless nights. It's starting to imagine things that aren't there. I think hypochondria sets in because you literally can't afford it. And it's that constant worry. And until you're put in that position, you don't know what that's
like. I've been in that position, so I know exactly what you're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Where you feel a little twinge on your left shoulder.
You go, uh-oh.
Is this it? And in the long run, that makes your health status worse.
Worse, because that stress is not good for the body.
So you lost your coverage through you lost employer provided coverage.
Correct.
But 2013 rolls around, and there's no Medicaid expansion in Florida.
No.
So you wind up you do eventually get subsidized coverage through the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
How dramatic has the difference been?
It's been day and night. It's literally been day and night because, like I said before, I was one of those women I had fibroids, chronic fibroids. And so being diagnosed in 2009 and having to live...
I have three daughters. I know what we're talking about.
Exactly. Having to live with that pain and the certainty that there's nothing you can do about it but be in pain for X number of days every single month. Well, the ACA rolls around. I'm qualified. I'm eligible. I get my subsidy. And thankfully, April 7th of 2014, I had my them removed.
Oh, my.
Yes. Thanks to the ACA. Without that, I couldn't.
It would never have happened otherwise.
It would not have happened.
And so that's been a dramatic decrease in suffering and a dramatic increase in quality of life.
Absolutely.
Hasn't it?
I can get out of my bed every day of the week. I can get out of my bed.
I can enjoy some of that warmth and sunlight.
Absolutely. I don't have to be carried from one room to the next. I don't have to spend days on end in bed.
You were being carried?
I was literally being carried from one room, from my bed to the bathroom.
Yes. So... does it feel, and I've been asking people the last couple of days, does it feel like this lawsuit has a personal element to it? Does it feel like a personal affront against Julie?
It feels personal. I take it personally. I can't help but take it personally because I know where I've been. I know where I don't want to go back to. So the fact that is being threatened by semantics is really frustrating.
Semantics, ideology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And since they have provided nothing in the way of their own idea,
mm-hmm.
then their only solution is for you to just go back to your status quo ante, right?
Absolutely, which is, again, suffering, pain, uncertainty, stress, huge stress.
And yet this is the party that says they're all about family values.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder how much they value our families.
Exactly.
Their family they might value, but I'm sure they don't give two hoots about mine.
I hate to admit mm-hmm. that that's the truth, but
yeah.
I strongly suggest or suspect that mm-hmm. it is. So what are you, do you advocate when you're back at home in Miami? I mean, do you try to get out in the community and say, listen, this will work for you?
Absolutely. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine and former colleague, actually. I worked in government, funny enough. I worked in municipal government.
Oh, my. Miami so, municipal and,
yeah,
government?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's like working in a circus, isn't it?
Banana Republic.
I've read my Carl Hiaasen books and my Dave Barry books. So.
Yes, Dave Barry, one of our favorites. But she, again, you know, her husband is a vet, and she's now consulting. And were it not for ACA, you know, a couple weeks ago her husband was hit off his bike. He was riding around town and got hit and spent days in the hospital and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars
sure.
in hospital bills. This is a professional, small business owner who employs 12 to 14 folks. And were it not for ACA, he would have been bankrupt. It literally would have come down to...
And there would have been a downhill effect to those 12 to 14 people
absolutely.
That he's employing.
Absolutely. It's that ripple effect.
And yet yeah. the other side says that they're the party that believes that wants to support job creators and small business.
That's not job creation in any stretch of the imagination. When people's livelihoods are at stake, if one person gets hurt and can't afford or have to sell their house or the business goes under, then that ripple effect, how is that job security and family values?
So were you out front during the protests this morning?
I was out front, front and center.
In the 39 degrees?
Absolutely, frozen toes.
Absolutely. They don't sell coats where you come from.
We couldn't find gloves, so I was literally freezing.
But you saw the other side there with mm-hmm. their, oh, my God, I hate the IRS signs.
Yes.
Did it feel like you were just looking at people from another planet?
I don't understand in this day and age how one human being can't empathize with another. It just, for me, it doesn't make sense. And probably prior to 2009, I must say, I might not have been able to. But come 2009, and I was in that position where I needed to have access to health care and couldn't afford it, things changed. Things changed drastically. Because, you know, again, being diagnosed with this painful, painful condition and not being able to do anything about it, I had to look for help, and my help came through the ACA.
Well, we will both cross our fingers and hope that we get the right result out of this, and preferably sooner rather than later, because you've got to be on pins and needles now.
Absolutely. It's reverting to 2009, and yeah, it's reverting. And I don't understand how we take one step back and one step forward and 10 steps back. This is not a dance.
No, it
this is
not.
My life.
Julie Mansfield, thank you so very kindly for
it's
your
a pleasure.
Time. I wish
thank
you the
you.
Very best. Thank you for being here, and safe travels back home to Miami.
Thank you so much.
Warm, wonderful.
Oh, yes,
Miami.
I'm looking forward to sunshine again.
Yeah, I'm going back to the hills and hollers of West Virginia, so don't rub it in,
okay? I'll send you some sunshine.
You do that. Thank you.
thank
Be
you.
Well. Take care.
Thanks.
From Miami, Florida, that's Julie Mansfield, and she does a magnificent job as all of these workaday, ordinary Americans have in explaining why this matters as much as it does and putting a real face on it all. Let's see. Wendell? Wendell Potter is on his way in. He spent 20 years, and I'm sure you already know his name. I'm a fan. I respect and admire the courage that he has shown over the last several years. 20 years, Wendell Potter was a health insurance insider, and he went whistleblower on Cigna. He authored Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and has made health insurance reform and education his life's mission over the last several years. It's awfully good to see you again, Wendell.
Thanks so much, Bob. Good to be back.
And thank you for the good work that you've been doing.
Appreciate
I follow you at a distance. I rather suspected I would be seeing you when we got to this radio row because
it's important.
This issue is in your wheelhouse, isn't
it? It is. Nothing to me is more important than what's going on here today. There's so much at stake.
Where does this case come from?
You know, it comes from political ideology, to tell you the truth. It comes from those who have been persuaded to think that the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as many call it, is something that really isn't. They see it as a threat for some reason that baffles me. But they think that it is an overstep of the government to structure the health insurance market the way they have.
And yet we have civilized countries all over the planet who manage to provide health care via universal single payer for their citizens. And I haven't seen any recent news reports saying that they have descended into some sort of Kenyan Muslim usurpation fascism, whatever that is that's driving the right wing crazy.
Oh, exactly right.
This is still very much a for-profit system, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. In fact, you can make the point that the Affordable Care Act props up the for-profit health insurance system, and a big part of our health care system outside of insurance is also for-profit, run by for-profit businesses. And the insurance industry and the hospital industry have done gangbusters, and so has the pharmaceutical industry since this law was passed.
Well, I mean, there's just a great big bucket of free money sitting in front of them, isn't it?
A lot more money, yes. People are finally able to get the care that they need.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this law, the way it has restructured the healthcare, the health insurance market. There absolutely is a lot more money. It's strengthening the economy by enabling people to get the care that they need in the right setting.
So, given your years on the inside, perhaps you can explain this to me. We have this obviously ideologically driven right-wing suit courtesy of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Right.
And you've got some seriously, in my opinion, ginned-up plaintiffs who apparently didn't even know what was being done in their name in some instances.
Right.
And yet, this is coming from the Republican side of things, and this is a party that listens to corporate America. Has nobody from the big health insurance companies picked up the phone and said, "Listen, John Boehner, what are you doing? 56 votes repealing this. What's going through your mind? Don't you realize we like this?" Because I haven't seen stories from the health insurance industry saying, "Oh, God, this really stinks, this free money we're getting."
Yeah. It's complicated. You have to understand what the industry's end game is here. Definitely, the insurance industry wants the law to stay in place. But on the other hand, they like to have Republicans in office because they generally are more likely to roll back regulations. And so they're playing, they're walking a tightrope on one hand because they want to keep the law in place. But on the other hand, they're willing for John Boehner and others to demonize the law because they know it, by doing so, and the evidence is already in we've seen the evidence of it, to help Republicans win elections. The House is now controlled by the Republicans, and so is the Senate. It has worked as a political issue. And I say, though, you've got to be, at some point, they've got to be very careful, because if they were to reach the point of having so many and having the expectations that they would actually repeal this law, they'd be in trouble then.
And I guess the insurance industry being what it is, ultimately their dream scenario is to receive the premiums and never have to actually provide any coverage.
You are exactly right. The dream there, and that's why I'm saying that they would like to see some of the regulations roll back. They don't like some of the new regulations that require them to be more consumer friendly, and they would like to be able to push more and more of the cost of care from them to us. So that's why they're willing to let John Boehner do this, because the more Republicans there are, the greater the likelihood they might do that. This law will not be repealed, I can tell you that, even if there is a Republican in the White House, because it means too much to the health care system for this law to go forward.
Well, what does it mean if the Competitive Enterprise Institute manages to win this case? Or is that just unspeakably incomprehensible? Is that just unthinkable to you?
it should be unthinkable, but I don't take anything for granted. I think it's, you know, certainly impossible that the court could agree with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and hold that these subsidies are unlawful. If they do, it will result in a meltdown of the insurance market in those states that did not set up their own exchanges, unless those states hurry up and build their own exchanges. And that's not likely to happen.
Doesn't it also run the risk of a meltdown inside the insurance industry itself?
It will. It will. And the insurance industry filed an amicus brief with the court to explain what would happen in very compelling scenarios of what will happen. And they pointed to history. There have been some states that have tried to do some things that just have backfired, and it would set up the same scenario if the court rules for the plaintiffs.
Well, I mean, an insurance company doesn't just sit there and watch the money roll in all year long, and then, you know, around Christmas declare bonuses. There's rate making involved, isn't there?
Oh yeah, and in fact, my current column, points out that unfortunately for us, the very fact that the court took this case means that rates probably going to be higher next year than they otherwise would be, and that's because of the timing of this. The court will not announce its decision until late June. Insurance companies.
Do you feel really, really solid on that? I mean, you don't think that the court might look at it and say, listen, this is important that we get a decision out there. Is it June 30th and they go on vacation?
It's entirely possible. I'm hoping that they will. Tradition has them waiting until June to have decisions on important cases like this, and that may be what happens. But we'll see.
I can't imagine. That anybody in the insurance industry would. I guess the only. I guess Steve King would be happy. I noticed that he was out regaling the right wingers who showed up in front of the Supreme Court today. But even the people who so vociferously hate this, what do they get out of it if they win?
It's a victory that I think is sort of like, what does a dog do if it catches the car? Then what are you going to do?
I mean, this becomes truly a Pyrrhic victory because
it is exactly that.
You know, King Pyrrhus said that they said congratulations on your victory.
Yeah,
and he said one more of those and we're finished.
Yeah, and I honestly think it would be devastating for the Republican Party because people would I really think make the connection that it was the Republican opposition to this. It was Republicans behind or the conservatives behind this lawsuit that would result in their losing their coverage, and not just those getting subsidies, by the way, in the marketplaces where this would be most impactful. Everybody who gets coverage in the individual market would face the same predicament.
And this is a complicated structure.
It is very complicated.
It's far more complicated than Medicare for All. It's far complicated than the universal single payer system.
Yeah.
And because of that complication, even assuming that a sudden bolt of responsibility and functionality were to descend upon the Congress right now.
Right.
It is wholly unreasonable to think that if the subsidies are struck down, that they could somehow get their act together, sober up, I'd say, long enough to put in a fix. Because the fix would be equally complex, would it not have to be?
It would have to be. People have criticized this law for being big and complex. But we've got a big and complex health care. We get the most complex health care system in the world with many, many problems, and the law tries to address as many as it could.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you very kindly for finding time to come by and have a conversation. It is always a joy to talk to you because I get a lot of clarity that I spend most of my time sitting around scratching my head. Is going on here. Because I can't fathom this. I don't know how
it's a head scratcher.
I don't know how this got in the court. It's not a constitutional issue.
No.
People already have something. Right. The court's being asked to take something away that people already
exactly.
have.
Exactly. It makes no sense.
It doesn't. And the only
well, here thing, we are.
But there were four justices that wanted to hear this.
That's right.
What's terrifying.
I know. And you just hope there's not a fifth.
Or we'll all need a fifth. Wendell Potter, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care, Bob.
Wendell Potter is an American. It takes a lot of courage to walk away from the position he was in and begin doing, telling truth that I suppose you could say the insurance industry did not want told. And we always have a good conversation. And, well, okay, I'll tell a little secret. My great-great-grandmother, or my great-great-grandfather, was a potter. And so, you know, he's got an Appalachian background, so you know, it's all kinfolks, right? So we've got more guests coming along. And I think one of the more interesting, let's see, I got a couple of minutes here. Let me see if I can get this to play. No, I know what I'm looking for. Here we go. I thought you might find this interesting just because we've had so many people coming through here talking about how critical it is that people who have insurance get to keep their insurance. Behold, then, the other side. There's an outfit out there called the Independent Women's Voice. And, of course, they're anything but independent. This is, you know, another captive right-wing AstroTurf group. Supreme Court should side with petitioners, reinstate Obamacare as written and intended, and open door to changes to health policy. This courtesy of Victoria.Coley at IWVoice.org. Today is the Supreme Court. Here's oral argument in King versus Burwell. Heather Higgins, President and CEO of Independent Women's Voice, released the following statement.
Today we urge the Supreme Court justices to uphold Obamacare as originally written, not as later revised and extended by the IRS when only a few states took the carrot of subsidies and signed up to these state exchanges and free.
Notice the Orwellian language here.
And free millions of Americans in as many as 37 states from the burdens of Obamacare's mandates and penalties.
Dear God. See, Obamacare as written. Freeing people. Yeah, because after all, they're the wild-eyed right wing. They're going to, they're about freedom.
A decision against the government will not repeal Obamacare, but will only return the system to what was written in the law as passed by Congress. Such a ruling would undo the decision by HHS and the IRS on their own authority to send tax dollars to insurance companies in states that declined to accept them because those states chose to protect their citizens as best they could from mandates and penalties.
Oddly enough, they didn't care about protecting them against catastrophic illness, grim death, misery, bankruptcy. No. Freedom! Right? Oh, my God. So you get the idea. We'll come back to that, maybe. Let me pull up my next bio. Oh, damn it. We are back to our conversations here at Radio Row, courtesy of Families USA on Capitol Hill, across from the Supreme Court of the United States. It's about 11 minutes past the hour, and I'm joined at this point in time by Dick Woodruff. He's Vice President of Federal Relations and Strategic Alliances with the American Cancer Society Action Network here in Washington, D.C., and I can imagine that you've had, you feel very much like you've got a vested interest in the outcome of this litigation.
We sure do, Bob. We were involved in the actual drafting of this legislation because we knew that 14 million cancer survivors in the United States and patients had no access to insurance because of their pre-existing condition. And if you don't have good coverage, you're not going to have good health outcomes if you have a really expensive disease like cancer. It's going to bankrupt you and cause you to seek less treatment, short on your pills and all of that. So this is a very important piece of legislation.
Absolutely. And even outside the economic concerns, which are significant, there's the question of aftercare and follow-up care. And someone without adequate coverage who manages to survive cancer is not necessarily going to be able to do the follow-up that they need.
Well, sure. There are all sorts of symptoms of treatment that are long-lasting into survivorship that patients have to deal with. Chemotherapy is a highly poisonous substance that you put in your body to cure your disease. You live, but there are all sorts of after effects.
So you were, the American Cancer Society was involved in the drafting of the Affordable Care Act. In the halls there of the home office, was there some furniture kicking going on when this got accepted to be argued before the Supreme Court?
Well, we were a little disappointed because we thought the Supreme Court had already acted on the constitutionality of the law back in 2012. Right, and so this challenge seemed to be so specious, there was never any question in anybody's mind that these subsidies wouldn't apply to all 50 states. It just seems ridiculous to assume that they would only be available in the state.
Right. Why should a state, by virtue of its own incompetence, get to nullify a law that's intended to cover every state?
Well, what doesn't make any sense is that many states, the very states that did not want to create exchanges and went to the federal exchange, were the ones who didn't like the law in the first place. So, you know, it's the states who created their own exchanges that will continue to live on, but 36 states will if this case wins in the Supreme Court, 36 states, people in those states will lose their subsidies. That's about 9 million people have insurance.
And how does that not wind up in the net creation of a separate but equal America relative to health care?
Well, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't. Well, then, when we look at this this case, and I think I think this is specious and it's just dummied up. Have you heard anything today about how the arguments went? Were issues of standing or justiciability even raised?
Well, I don't know about that. I did hear a few things about it, which led to some optimism. Justice Roberts didn't say anything, but Justice Kennedy, who had earlier voted against the law in 2012, made the argument that weren't the plaintiffs actually threatening the states by withholding these subsidies? Wasn't that a coercive, unconstitutional coercive use of federal power? That was the very same sort of coercive federal power that the Supreme Court struck down when it made the Medicaid expansion discretionary.
Right.
And I don't know if you're... No, readers know all about that, but the original law said that Medicaid would be expanded for all 50 states.
Yeah, it was as universal as was the for-profit mandate.
Right, and the Supreme Court found that to be coercive toward states that didn't want to expand. Now the Supreme Court is asking, isn't it coercive to take away subsidies for states who didn't want to do an exchange? It doesn't square with your earlier position.
To what extent do you think the court do you think that they are able to comprehend and connect to the real world aspects of this case to the people like we've had like I've had the pleasure of meeting over the last couple of days who come through here and say, listen, my life is dramatically worse without this coverage, or is this just ivory tower arcana?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that question. One of the reasons why the American Cancer Society led an effort to do an amicus brief on this, and we brought in the Heart Association, the Diabetes Association, and the Multiple Sclerosis Association, was to try to demonstrate to the court what the real-world impact of this decision would be. If you take those four diseases and you add those up, virtually every American is guaranteed to have one of those diseases by the end of their lifetime and need health care. And so the idea was to present to the court that this sort of health coverage is absolutely necessary. Now, there is some sense that this court does live in a bubble, but they had to get in the building today, and they had to see those people out there, so hopefully they know.
Yeah, they've got their big 250-foot buffer zone rule. Dick Woodruff, thank you very kindly for stopping by and for engaging in conversation with me. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you to the organization for leading the way in the amicus filing.
Thank you, Bob. And let me just say, if anybody wants any further information,
yes,
acscan.org is the place to find it.
acscan.org.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very kindly.
You bet.
And that's the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Dick Woodruff, the Vice President of Federal Relations and Strategic Alliances. Thank you very kindly, and have a great, great afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye now. And it is about 17 minutes past the hour. In short order, we will be talking to Leslie Fried. And I'm and there's Leslie. I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you for being right there and ready to jump right in. Leslie comes to us from the National Council on Aging. She's the senior director of the Center for Benefits Access. There's got to be I don't want to say a gray area because that's just a little too punny, but there's a space between, and I occupy it, between being not young, not retirement age, not Medicare age, and that is the frightening space where I think the controversy in King versus Burwell resides. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair, and that's why the National Council on Aging was so concerned about the case. There are many people, 55 to 64, they lose their jobs, they leave their jobs due to illness, they retire, and then they have a significant period of time for which, prior to the Affordable Care Act, they did not have health insurance. And people just wait until they're eligible for Medicare,
yeah,
which is 65.
That's the age of praying, right? I mean, because before the Affordable Care Act, that's what you had.
Exactly. And people, before the Affordable Care Act, the premiums could be significantly higher if people could get health insurance, and they were often based on pre-existing conditions.
Right.
So the Affordable Care Act, people just could not afford health insurance prior to Medicare.
So if the subsidies are struck down, which we sincerely hope they're not, but this is... I've learned not to assume anything about the Roberts Court. I don't assume that they could agree on whether or not people should tie their shoelaces to keep from falling on their faces. But you have a significant constituency who is immediately and dramatically harmed if they should happen to rule with the plaintiffs in this case, do you not?
Sure. Well, we know that in the 34 states, over 9 million people would be affected. There's a variety of statistics out there, but we understand that it could be as high as 35% of people who are older adults would be affected by the loss of their premiums and cost-sharing subsidies. And for those people, they probably won't be able to afford health insurance and thus lose access to health care.
Right. It's the access to the coverage that defines whether or not there's access to the care.
Exactly.
What have you argued? I presume you're part of a larger coalition with other organizations trying to preach or teach a little bit of common sense to the court. Were you part of one of the amicus filings?
Sure, we signed on with an amicus brief with AARP and National Health Law Program and SAGE, and we were all focused on the pre-Medicare older adult population, specifically people who are not eligible for Medicaid in their communities, don't have access to affordable health care, reliant on the premiums and the subsidies in order to get health insurance, yet they're not Medicare yet. And I just want to make one quick point is that prior to the Affordable Care Act, there has been a lot of research that shows people who are uninsured before they enroll in Medicare actually are more expensive that first year of Medicare because they've gone without
up.
Exactly. They've gone without care. They may have had diabetes or other health care conditions, other chronic conditions, and they're much more expensive that first year to the Medicare program.
Well, let me ask you this, because it's we've got 34 states, but we also have that sort of Venn diagram overlay with the old Confederacy states, mostly that rejected the expansion of the Medicaid access and eligibility. If a person is in a state like Alabama that doesn't have expanded Medicaid, then access to the federal exchange is their only hope, isn't it?
Exactly. That is their hope for access to affordable health care, is through the federal exchanges. And similarly with Florida, and if you think about Florida, which I recently saw a graph that showed they would have the most to lose. They would have the most people who are losing access to subsidized premiums and cost sharing, and that's a state that has a significant older population.
And so these are people who might otherwise qualify for expanded Medicaid. And in Florida, at one point, wasn't the governor going to accept the, and then the legislature?
Exactly. The governor actually had decided to move forward with expanded Medicaid, and then their legislature I don't know if they vetoed it or they refused to approve it. And so there's a significant population in Florida that would have no access to health insurance and health care.
Well, you're a member of the Supreme Court Bar.
You read my bio.
I did. Do you do any tea leaf reading? You get out the crystal ball at all?
We can only be... listen to the questions and the responses and think positively that hopefully, especially Justice Kennedy's questions and comments and equating it to the previous health care decision law with regard to striking down actually the requirement that the states have Medicaid expansion, because the court said that it was coercive. So he made a similar analogy in today's argument.
So do we ever see an end to this godforsaken litigation? I mean, I love the opportunity to come up here and have these conversations, do these interviews. But at some point in time, I would like for our country to have some degree of certainty about access to health care and access to health insurance. Is this going to be the end of it, or are they going to go and, like W.C. Fields sitting on his porch as an old man reading his Bible, and Fields, what are you looking at? He said, looking for a loophole. Are we going to get one case after another, after another, after another?
Well, we can only hope that at some point the reality that health insurance for all in our country is important and it's a right. But there are some people there are some groups that disagree with that and will take every step necessary to at least attempt to strike down the law. What's interesting is that 22 states signed on to an amicus brief supporting the subsidies in their states, and these are states who opted not to have their own exchanges, so their citizens have a lot to lose. Yep. And many of those states actually went the other way in the previous litigation. So they know that this case is so important to the health and well-being of their citizens.
I mean, I know some of that from the reality of coming from West Virginia, as I do. We took money from the federal government to study setting up a state exchange, and we looked at it for a long time, and once we'd made sure that the check had cleared, and once we'd made sure we already spent the money, we said, you know, we studied it, and we don't think we want one of those. We want to go with the federal. So there were conscious choices made to go with the federal exchange in the case of just about every state that is on the federal exchange, especially your southern states. From a legal standpoint, isn't it a little bit, what's Well, isn't it a little bit like wanting to have one's cake and eat it too, to say, well, you know, we're not going to set up a state exchange, we're going to participate in the federal exchange. And by the way, you know, the laws, we can't take that money anyway. Our people can't have that money. It seems almost like a 155-year-old nullification argument, isn't it?
Right. Well, one could suggest that. You know, they're just certain states and certain, I want to say, governors and attorney generals who they will never agree to the importance of, and they call it Obamacare,
yeah,
and
right.
the importance of it, and the importance of access to health care for their citizens. And I think that that's just a reality we need to live with. And it's not that dissimilar in 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid, of which we have our 50th anniversary this
right.
year, when that started, there was a lot of, it wasn't as litigious, but there was a lot of acrimony about those laws. And here we are 50 years later.
Yeah, they made the argument that it'll collapse the economy.
Exactly.
People will disappear. Gotcha.
Exactly. So here we are 50 years later, and but for those programs, you know, our seniors and significantly low-income citizens in our country would not have access to health care.
Well, Leslie Fried, thank you very much for dropping by. Best of luck at the National Council on Aging.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It was a real joy. It really
Thanks.
Was. And we will continue on winding down in my portion of the program. We will wrap things up in a little bit and hand off, turn things over to the one and only inimitable, accept no substitutes, Guy James, who has been my broadcast colleague here on a number of occasions. I was tickled to see him able to be back this time through. He'll pick up at about 3 o'clock. And I, for my part, and with Ferg, we'll begin to break down some stuff and pack up some stuff and get ready. We'll be getting on the road this evening. I don't know how far down the road we're going to get. It's kind of wet and crappy outside, so we'll be driving into I-66 traffic, and I-66 westbound is, of course, the largest parking lot in northern Virginia between the hours of about 3 and 8. So we'll see how that all plays out. Let's see. We'll be waiting for our next guest will be Larry Minix, who is the president and CEO of Leading Age. Leading Age is an organization, a not-for-profit organization, an association of organizations. That are dedicated to making America a better place in which to grow old. Because this country has been a brutal place in which to grow old from time to time. For much of this nation's early history, that has been the case. So, Larry Minix, welcome to the Horn. Welcome to Radio Row.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in conversation.
It's an honor.
Tell us a little bit more about Leading Age, please.
Leading Age is made up of 6,000 mostly nonprofit aging services providers, but businesses and professionals, lawyers, doctors. We're in virtually every neighborhood in America, and
really,
our members have been serving their communities on average for about 75 years.
What does it mean when you say that you're all dedicated to making America a better place to grow old? How do we make America a better place to grow old?
Well, the ACA actually took a huge step in doing that, and some of the new innovative pathways it created for that, but we have a growing, the society is growing older. That means health care becomes increasingly important. It needs to be more tailor-made. People want to stay at home as long as they can, so there's less of an emphasis on institutionalization.
Right, nursing
homes. Than there used to be. And the nursing home is still very important, but it's going to be for people that just absolutely cannot be anywhere else.
So you support like the mobility solutions.
Oh yes.
Independence solutions.
You bet.
Okay.
Housing options. Believe it or not, there's 11 people on a waiting list for every low-income housing HUD or public housing project in America, and those people are can be helped to stay there longer if they have a roof over their head through relatively inexpensive visits from a nurse practitioner or making sure they get meals or transportation to the doctor.
Far less expensive than institutional alternatives.
Yes. Okay. And the ACA actually helped make some of those kind of services easier to develop.
Really?
Yeah.
And that was along the lines of my next question, was to find out, you said at the beginning of our conversation that the ACA had made growing older in America a much more humane proposition.
You bet.
How does that, what are the mechanics of that?
Well, for one thing, it's put more emphasis on helping family caregivers help older people stay at home. Because families do care. They are the burden of the responsibility. On any given day, there are about 11 million seniors that are cared for at home by their families. And some of the programs, especially through things like the Older Americans Act, need to be strengthened as time goes on. But the ACA provided for innovation around more managed care, community-oriented models, and that's good for everybody.
Absolutely. It is hard enough to grow old.
Yes.
It should not be a brutality in a country that considers itself to be civilized.
Well, there's another angle of it, too, that people forget about, and that is that in aging services, more than any other part of health care, you're dependent on direct care people to do the work. And so we have, for example, amongst our members, an estimated million employees, the majority of whom are direct care, lower wage people. So the ACA...
We're talking like certified nursing assistants.
Right, and nutrition support people and maintenance and homemaker health aid people. Those make our world go round.
Absolutely, and it is not the highest paid portions of the healthcare industry, but it is a significant percentage of the funds paid out.
You bet. In our world,
and so the ACA enables more of that.
Yes, because people have health insurance. The best proxy we have for quality is staffing, and many of these people heretofore before the ACA didn't have the option for health insurance, and that's why it's so important to keep the ACA in place.
So you've obviously studied the issues that are in King versus Burwell. What happens if the unthinkable happens and some majority of the nine robes over there decides that? And I don't even know what they'll be agreeing with if they agree with the plaintiffs, frankly, because it's the complaint is so incomprehensibly bizarre. I walked over there a little earlier today, and I saw a bunch of people walking around with signs about the IRS, and I wanted to just yell Benghazi just to see what they do. But what happens to the care, to the quality of care that you're talking about and that your organization advocates for if these plaintiffs get their way?
Well, to think that you could pull the plug on coverage in the exchanges for lower income people over the parsing of a half a dozen words is virtually unthinkable. But that's what we're facing.
Yeah, it is.
And so what that would mean is that all this is rhetorical kit till it gets to be your son or daughter that doesn't have insurance.
Yeah.
Or your family member that's suddenly not covered, and then it becomes a real issue. So while we're talking about the the rhetorical theoretical. We're actually messing with the lives of real people.
Well, and that's and I think that's
they get sick every day and they have to go to the emergency room or alternatives or they don't get help.
That's the real takeaway here, isn't it? Because this is not simply some sort of ivory tower academic issue because it's already in place. This is not a constitutional discussion about whether or not the ACA is legal. That's been settled. People are already getting it. And I'm asking for speculation from you, I suppose, but what kind of gall does it take? What kind of nerve does it take to look at people who are already benefiting from something and saying, well, I'm sorry, our weird right-wing definition of freedom trumps your ability to have, you know, somebody come and cook you a meal twice a week?
Well, let's if you take it out of the realm of right-wing, left-wing wing and say, what does compassionate common sense mean to a major program like this, then we'll come out all right. Because I haven't met anyone left, right, or center that that didn't take a common sense approach if they have a mother with Alzheimer's disease or a child with MS or a grandson with autism or that surgery that that they need to have. It becomes real then. So I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will pull the politics out of it and look at common sense.
So does, you know, the House has voted, what, 56 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it's been 56 futile acts. We now have this case being argued today. Does the constant hooting and hollering and the legal wrangling and the meaningless procedural votes, does this have a real world impact on your organization's delivery of services? I mean, are they kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop?
It creates anxiety, no question about it, because you've got real lives affected. Secondly, it creates unpredictability in people's business models. Of how do you run an organization that's responsible for several hundred to several thousand people every day. When it comes down to it and you get below the noise, again, I have found people of all political persuasions that are interested in getting their mother, their son, their child, their wife covered.
Yeah. And so, the care that they need.
Yes, and I think Churchill said America ends up doing the right thing, but they try everything else first.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of the nature of our deliberative society. So there'll be more votes, and there was similar controversy over Social Security when it was implemented.
Yeah.
And people have, there are all kinds of misunderstanding about the death panels. There was never anything about
death panels.
Oh, my God. You know? And think about all that, and nobody talks about it anymore, but that was the code word du jour for through an election campaign.
Yeah, I guess we're all socialists now. I mean, even the hardcore profiteering the profit making capitalists. You know, now that
well,
we've
got that, that's another thing that that I hope the Supreme Court will take into account, and that is that I don't know of a single segment of the healthcare industry that's not in favor of the ACA.
Well, and the hospitals and
the
insurance
major
companies,
insurance,
they all filed amicus briefs opposing these plaintiffs. And you know, going back to something you said a minute ago, I think maybe the best example of what you said about the real world responses that people have to healthcare needs was when the Wall Street Journal went out and actually tracked down these various and sundry plaintiffs, and they asked the lady, do you know that if you win your case, millions of people will lose access to health care? And she said, well, I don't want nobody to lose no health care.
Yeah, I remember being interviewed on a talk show during the ACA debate, and this woman called in to say, I just don't want the government messing with my Medicare or Medicaid.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
You know, and
how do you not just run screaming
and
into
the
night?
Well, I said, you do realize that those are programs that are provided by the government, but it was like I was speaking a different language.
Yeah, you just transitioned immediately into Martian.
Yeah.
Well, Larry Minix, I really appreciate you coming by.
Oh, thanks for your coverage, your continued coverage of these issues. Yeah.
It means a lot to me, because coming from West Virginia as I do, we have, and I guess I am now part of, as hard as I try to resist it, an aging population.
Yeah.
And
you're an aging state with a lot of chronic illness.
Yeah. For a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And as a consequence, and you know, I don't know what happened. My state went crazy.
Mm.
And you know, they holler about how, I mean, we're fortunate. We've got the expanded Medicaid.
Yep.
And we're participating in a federal exchange, but if they win here, I'm not sure how many hundreds of thousands of West Virginians are going to be without care.
Just appreciate the irony of a conservative state like West Virginia and Kentucky that bought into the new Medicaid program and created exchanges, and look at how many people are covered in a conservative state. And when you can take progressive steps in a conservative state, and now what happens to all that?
Yeah.
And you've got a low socioeconomic. So what happens to poor people that for the first time in their lives can get treatment? That's just nuts to think that we don't do that.
Well, it is. And among other things, you know, there's no such thing as the coal industry proves. There's apparently in West Virginia, there's no such thing as a bad job. And so this is the expansion of the Medicaid, the access to health care through the federal exchange, has begun a flowering of a healthcare renaissance. People going into healthcare fields who are going to have decent jobs for 40 years.
You know, that's frequently forgotten in the whole healthcare thing. As healthcare improves, it creates jobs and employment for people that are good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often forgotten in this whole discussion.
Well, it isn't lost on me, because I know how many people are getting jobs, having jobs. My own daughter she's going to graduate high school this spring, and she's going to be a CNA when she graduates, and she's just going to build on that and go and become an RN and go to college and be an RN and maybe go on.
There you go.
And look at, well, looky there, a future just happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I thank you very kindly
for dropping by.
Thank
you. Keep up your great coverage. We appreciate it very much.
Well, I appreciate you coming by, and I appreciate the work that your organization does.
Thank you.
God bless. And you as well, sir. Be well. And maybe spring will come someday. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to think it's been canceled for lack of interest or something.
Until the Supreme Court makes the right decision, we're going to have winter.
Well, I wish Tony Scalia would step out and not see his shadow or something. Well, maybe we could get a little break.
Take care.
Be well. Take care. Coming to us from Leading Age, that was Larry Minix, president and CEO of the organization. And here comes our last conversation for the day. I mentioned a moment ago in talking with Larry that if one isn't careful, one can look up and see a future appearing right before one's eyes. And I thought it would be nice to end the program today. You can go ahead and put your cans on. It might make things a little easier. I thought it would be nice to end the program today with a view of the future. And toward that end, one of the young women who has been interning here, helping shepherd guests around to the tables from program to program to program, is Maddie Davin.
Yes.
And Maddie is from the D.C. area, and she is a high school senior. And Maddie is having a conversation with me because you're about to go and, even though you were raised here in the D.C. area, you're about to go and become a mountaineer of sorts, aren't you? You're moving to West Virginia next fall.
Yes, that's right. I'll be going to Wheeling Jesuit University in Wheeling, West Virginia.
And I think it seems to me that you're very much excited. You took what, 4 campus visits?
Yes, 1 over the summer and then 3 over the course of the year.
So who did Wheeling Jesuit win out over?
I looked at 2 other schools, Providence in Rhode Island and St. Michael's in Vermont.
Wow. Well, that says something that you're willing to go to Wheeling.
Yes.
What do you plan on studying?
Theology and history.
That will be fun. Don't Be careful, though. Be careful, because coming to a place like West Virginia, you never know. You might just wind up becoming an activist of some sort, because there's a lot of stuff to work toward. What have you thought of the Radio Rope? Is this the first time you've ever done this?
Yes, it is. I've never really considered a career in journalism or media, so this is definitely interesting and something new.
How did it come about?
The dean of students at my school knows Candy Stroud, who helped organize the whole event.
Candy is a dynamo.
Yes.
And so you've just been keeping people on schedule, on track, and getting them from point A to point B.
Basically, yes.
Does it just look like organized chaos to you? I'm so used to doing these kinds of things, I don't know.
Yeah. In the morning, for like the first hour or so, it was pretty calm like this, and then we had 3 or 4 hours of controlled chaos, and now we're back into a more mellow period.
So I have to ask you, apart from knowing that you're going to Wheeling Jesuit, what else do you know about West Virginia? What do you know about the Mountain State?
It's wild and wonderful.
Okay.
Other than that, I know it's beautiful. I don't know much else. I think in terms of state government, you just had a really young woman elected into
18 years,
yes,
old, and I think she's got an IQ to match, because she's she's right-wing and Republican, and that's unfair of me. I can tell you this much, the best gravy fries,
okay,
in Wheeling are to be had at the Alpha.
Okay.
I didn't go to school up there, but I got a bunch of buddies who did, and I've been dragged off to the Alpha on more than one occasion. Great French fries covered in brown gravy, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, they really hit the spot. But you won't be going to the Alpha at 2 o'clock in the morning, because you're going to be a very, very serious student who's going to be hitting the books and working on that summa cum laude graduation from day one, right?
Of course.
Absolutely. I can hear the sincerity in your voice, and see the determined light in your eyes. Well, Maddie, I wish you the very, very best, and it's been a pleasure getting to know you here at Radio Row. And, well, if you ever have any questions on, things West Virginia, holler at Candy. She'll put you in touch with me, and we'll try to answer any questions you may have.
I will do that. Thank you.
Wonderful. And seriously, good luck. Good luck. I'm sure you'll be a great student.
Thank you so much.
Bye now. Upcoming college freshman at Wheeling Jesuit University, Maddie Davin. And it is time to wrap things up here, because I got to get out of the chair and let Guy James get into the chair. He's got 2 hours of scintillating progressive broadcast coming for you in the next, he'll be here in a few minutes. He's been over there taking a couple of pictures. Thank you, Guy James. I saw you taking pictures there. And he'll have more interviews. It has, mercifully, because yesterday was kind of a technical disaster, today has been surprisingly calm and easy, and that's always the best way to have it. It's just downright nice. So what's going to happen is this evening, as soon as Guy gets done, Ferg and I are going to start tearing down and loading out. And then I think we're going to get Guy to the airport, and then we will be on the road for home. We'll be on the air most likely on the air at 6 p.m. regular time tomorrow evening from the fabulous Kincaid Mansion Studios, and then Friday on the front porch will come your way, curiously enough, on Friday. Thanks for listening in. This will be replayed in the normal 6 p.m. time slot. And I'll start uploading that in short order. Thanks, everybody. Gentle reminder, this is all listener-supported. If you want to help out, run over to headonradionetwork.com, the tab Contribute, and go through the PayPal interface, or email me, bobkincaid@gmail.com, if you need the mailing address. We'll get it up on the website one of these days, but just not right now. So be well. Take care. And we'll talk soon. Guy James comes your way in 10 minutes.